This is the WGBH Forum Network.
I remember being repulsed by wrinkles, and now they're just a part of life.
We are living longer.
Another bypass surgery, another transplant.
But are we living better?
Nobody's bothered to think about what the repercussions are of trying to keep people alive longer and longer with such a limited ability to function.
Frontline confronts the new realities of living old. Watch online or on air starting November 21st.
Good evening. My name is Mike Sullivan. I'm an executive producer for special projects at Frontline. I'd like to welcome you all here and thank you very much for coming out tonight for this special screening of Frontline's latest film. And I want to offer a special thanks to the Boston Center for Adult Education for hosting this event and to our colleagues at WGBH for all their assistance in planning tonight. In previous screenings of this film, we've done a few sort of test screenings here in Boston, and we had a big event in New York last night at Mount Sinai Medical Center where much of the film was shot. It seems to be that its virtue perhaps is it's a great conversation starter for the many personal and public issues that are provoked by exploring this world. And so we'd like to sort of have one of those conversations with all of you tonight. And to help guide us, we've put together a panel of very distinguished experts from our own community here who are experts in geriatrics and in the delivery of care to the elderly. I'd like to introduce them to you quickly here. First, seated next to me is Jennifer Davis Carey, who is Secretary of the Executive Office of Elder Affairs for the state of Massachusetts, where she plays a key role in the delivery of services to seniors. Since she assumed the position in 2003, Secretary Carey has focused a great deal of attention on defining and implementing the state's community first policy, which is aimed at allowing seniors to stay in their homes and communities as long as possible. Secretary Carey, thank you for being here tonight. Next to Secretary Carey is Dr. Richard Dupuy, who is a real expert in this field. He's the chief of geriatrics division at Tufts New England Medical Center and the president of the Massachusetts Geriatric Society. I guess that makes you the top expert these days. He is a nationally renowned expert in Alzheimer's disease, osteoporosis, and hypertension in the elderly, and in the use of prescription drugs by seniors, a very hot subject these days. Dr. Dupuy, thank you for being here. And next to Dr. Dupuy is Dr. Stephen Pinals. I'm getting that right, Pinals?
Pinals.
Pinals, thank you. I knew I'd messed that one up. Pinals. Who brings another really intriguing perspective to our discussion and to these issues from his position as a geriatric psychiatrist at the Cambridge Health Alliance, where he serves as the Associate Director for Geriatric Psychiatry and Director of the Geriatric Psychiatric Fellows Program. He also teaches as an instructor in psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. Dr. Pinals, thank you. So with those quick introductions, we'd like to plunge into our discussion. The plan is I'll throw a question or two at our panelists to get things started, and then we'll open things up for a discussion with all of you, and I hope you'll all feel welcome to participate. Dr. Dupuy, if I could start with you, there's an issue that just, every time I screen this film, it just leaps out at me, which is this idea that there aren't nearly enough geriatric physicians now, and it looks like it's just going to get incredibly worse as our population rapidly ages. Could you discuss with us a little bit, do we really have a crisis in medical staffing in this area? What is the scale of the problem, and what can or should we be doing about it?
Sure. Just look nationally. There are 700,000 doctors in America. 400,000 of these doctors are primary care doctors, internists, or family practitioners. That's 400,000. There are 4,000 geriatricians. That's 1% of the internal medicine population, and way less than 1% of the entire physician population. There are 144 medical schools in the United States. Less than half pay any attention to geriatrics whatsoever. In the year between 1985 and 2000, the number of residents, second and third year residents, going into primary care was approximately probably 50-60%. Last year, the number of residents, including from my own hospital down the street, the percentage of residents going into primary care was less than 20%. This year, it's predicted to be less than 15%. There are a lot of reasons that medical students, residents, don't go into primary care or internal medicine. But the reasons that they won't go into geriatrics are myriad, complicated, and not just related to the amount of time required or the finances. There's a level of interest that's just not filtering down from the deans of the medical schools down to the students. This is a problem that a lot of us know about, we talk about. I think it's a huge crisis, and I don't have a solution. But I think the way to get to the solution is to understand why we have this problem in the first place. Why do our students not want to go into primary care? Why do our students not want to go into geriatrics? Why do our subspecialists who go into surgery and cardiology and pulmonary and so on and so forth, why are they not interested in taking a little bit more time to learn about the very, very unusual characteristics of the kind of care that we give in geriatrics? If we can understand that, and I think to some extent we do, then we can at least begin to fix it. Let alone the fact that Washington made a decision that was just the death knell for geriatrics several years ago when they withdrew funding for geriatric fellowships. And so it's a complicated problem. There are complicated solutions. There isn't any one quick fix, and I don't see any quick fix on the horizon. So,
sorry so I asked.
If you're depressed, you should be. That's why we have a psychiatrist.
Okay, well, hopefully we can get a more hopeful answer next time here. Secretary Kerry, maybe I should try you here. You're smiling. Now, it's very obvious from the film that the elders require an enormous continuum of care that extends well beyond the hospital and the clinic. And I know this is where you focus a lot of attention, so could maybe you explore with us a little bit how we're doing, both as the government and as a society, in providing the services, this sort of all these steps and the services that people need to have as good an old age as one can. How are we doing, and what do we really need? Where are we succeeding, and where do we need improvement?
One of the national movements that we certainly see reflected here in Massachusetts is the need to rebalance, or to really bring a balance to the continuum of care that we have, assuring that we have a full spectrum of care for people from full independence to the round-the-clock specialized care that can be provided in a nursing facility. One of the things that we're doing here in Massachusetts is working to cultivate and develop the continuum of care that we call community-based care, and whether that's care in the home by family and other informal caregivers, or care in the home by professional paid caregivers, assisted living, rest homes, a whole host of community-based options to provide the varieties of care that people need. Also recognizing the need for specialized mental health services for elders, for the specialized care that people afflicted with Alzheimer's disease need, and so forth. So those are the kinds of things that are really the thrust of our community first policy here in Massachusetts.
And where in the balance, where, if you just take a wider look than even maybe beyond Massachusetts, where do you think we're doing well? Where do you see the real problem areas that need a lot more work?
One of the issues that we have is a tremendous shortage of caregivers. Now, one of the things that we have here in Massachusetts that we've recently expanded is our an adult family care program, which will allow elders to be cared for by family members, and for those family members to receive a small stipend. We're in the last phases of a ramp up of that. So we are seeing the caregiving issue for elders is in many ways where we were with child care 20 years ago. It's an issue for families. It's an issue for businesses. It is an issue that we see repercussions of in a host of areas.
So. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Pinels, okay, maybe switch you into another area here. We focus so much, I think, generally on the sort of physical problems that elders have as they age. But maybe you could explore with us a little bit the importance of the mental side, of the emotional life of seniors in the aging process. I mean, I assume it is because you're working in it. But how do you sort of weigh? I mean, you see some sort of vivid examples in the film. The gentleman with Parkinson's who says it's all for the. We can just feel his depression sort of riding him down and down and down along with all his physical problems.
Yes, the film is just powerful in that it begins with this model of aging, Estelle Strongman. And you see, probably in your own mind, as you envision your own aging, a successful and healthy, productive person who's very active and independent at home. And as we see the stories unfold, we see increasing dependence, frailty, losses, which include everything from health to home to spouses and family members, and the incredible destruction to the human relationships as we hear the older adult being interviewed, sort of reflected on their own aging and thinking about what might happen in the years ahead, and then moving to the caregivers and hearing about both their pride and the success they have in taking care of their loved one, and also the tremendous burden and the disappointment they endure as they're making decisions and confronting problems they never imagined. And then what really is the most beautiful aspect of this film, in my opinion, is when the camera's eye turns around and we hear the caregivers, the doctor and the nurse, and even the Dr. Cass reflect on their own experience of aging. And I think that's what forces us as viewers to think about, well, what's going to happen to us? You know, who's going to take care of us?
Can we sign this man up for a review of this film?
Thank you so much. After I saw this, I think, I've got to go home and tell my wife, we need more daughters. We need at least three daughters here. I'm going to end up in a nursing home.
That is one of the more vivid ideas in the film. Lots of people going around saying, how do I get three daughters quickly?
But one last, the most powerful aspect at the end when we're talking about decision-making capacity, which is something I do quite often in my work, and to assess somebody's capacity is really a challenge. But to be with a loved one or to be facing these decisions yourself and not understanding the complexity of the decisions. Putting a feeding tube is not just a tube. It really commits you to a way of life. And people don't understand their ramifications. And also we know our legal system and our healthcare system is really not capable of managing the overwhelming number of problems that will emerge in the years ahead as older adults with dementia, delirium, and mental health problems are unable to make good decisions on their own behalf. So I think this film really challenges us or inspires us to have these conversations with our parents or our children or our loved ones. What do we do? How do we prepare? What kinds of decisions might we plan for? Really, it's a very inspiring film.
Do you have any ideas? I mean, that's sort of the conversation between the children and the elderly is a... It's an intriguing issue that this film raises, and it's a sense we're getting from this film anyway is that those conversations are halting, and even Dr. Mueller, I think, talks about a sort of truncated conversation with his own parents about
no
expectations.
No, I agree.
You can't even get anywhere with them in terms of a discussion.
It's the most compelling part of the film because it's the most difficult thing to do is to talk about our own aging and planning for our own functional decline or physical decline. Having these conversations with loved ones is nearly impossible because of the feelings and emotions it brings up. Right. So often the conversations are placed upon the healthcare provider who doesn't really know the goals or dreams of their patient as well as they might. So I don't know the answer to your question. Yeah. I think it's more conversations like this as a beginning, and also naturally healthcare reform as a way of building up our geriatric medicine training programs and other social agencies to help allow these kinds of conversations to occur.
Dr. Dupuy, could I poke at you a little more about this staffing crisis, which you have described in even more dark terms than I had imagined it? And we got into this a little bit in Mount Sinai last night, but I'd like to get your opinion about it. Is the fact that Medicare is paying, and Medicaid to some extent, is paying for all of these services and the way the payments are coming into doctors, I mean, there's an enormous amount of time obviously required for caring for elderly, at least in the kind of way that we would all like it to happen. Is there really a mismatch here between the reimbursement schedules and the services that are actually required from physicians?
Yes, nurses? Unfortunately there is. What you don't see in the film is what Dr. Koch does after he visits his patients. And this is something a lot of the public really doesn't understand, but I'll tell you exactly what it's like because I do it every day. And that is, after he sees a patient, he must go and either dictate or write a note. But federal regulations require, in order to get reimbursed at whatever level, usually there are three levels in a nursing home, two levels in a home, in order to get reimbursed, there has to be a significant amount of information in what he writes or dictates. So much so that many physicians have turned to a template and kind of tweaked the template. And then he'll submit a bill, but he has to have a mechanism for submitting the bill to Medicare. And that mechanism is no longer, it can't be a bill that just goes into the mail and is sent to Medicare, because it has to be electronic now. That's significant overhead. And so at the end of the day, when his staff presumably has done all this and his notes are in place, he'll send his bills. And he has a good chance of having Medicare reject his bill and ask for more information, such as the note. And the note may not satisfy what Medicare feels is necessary for that level of care. A lot of people don't realize how complicated this is, but believe me, this is what happens. And so he may have to either resubmit it, which means that his payment for this visit will be delayed for maybe 3 or 4 months. It's really a very complicated morass. Well, I must say, however, that Medicare is of all the payers, of all the, including the commercial side, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Tufts, Harvard, Medicare is the best payer. And they're the easiest to work with. But again, it's a complicated procedure. It's called paperwork. It takes a lot of time. And in some cases, it takes almost as much time as you've spent with your patient. When I was younger, I had a general practitioner come and visit me when I had an attack of asthma in my home. And he had a little card like this. Now, granted, we didn't have the medications that we have now. But he would treat me. He'd probably write two or three things on a line and go off to his next house call. And those are the days when a lot of primary care doctors made house calls. Although this, the Dr. Koch is unusual, because it's rare, especially in this area, where you'll get a physician to make a house call. It's just such a complicated procedure to make it all happen. The easiest part of my day is when I close the door and sit with my patient. That's the easiest and best part of the day. The rest of it is a lot of work, and it's one of the reasons we can't get students to go into primary care.
Because of that ratio of work to paperwork.
Absolutely. Right?
Is compensation itself, is it just...
No, the reimbursements are not adequate for the task. There is a study that shows that if you're a geriatrician, for example, if you only see patients over the age of 65 in your private office, and you only do office visits, in other words, you just see patients every 15 minutes, every half hour, your overhead would be greater than the income that would be derived, and therefore you would not be able to survive. And that's why most geriatricians are within facilities such as Sinai. In Boston, it's Boston Medical and Tufts Medical Medical Center and Mass General and so on and so forth, because in Cambridge, and because they have the hospital support to understanding that the overhead is so intense that money comes from another section of the hospital setting or another corporate setting. Mm-hmm. But in private practice, it just doesn't happen. Sinai's geriatric program is supported by the hospital. It's also supported by donations.
Right.
Those bills go to Medicare, but they don't cover what these great physicians at Sinai do. Their work is not, the reimbursement does not cover the amount of work that they do.
Can we turn to the audience maybe here? Anyone have some questions they'd like to ask? Right here.
One thing that struck me about this film is it's not the all the people who are portrayed themselves on the film, but the direct care, you know, direct care takers. If you notice that they all minority or immigrant workers, and as the film showed that, you know, the number of elderly going to be increasing, which means that we need more of these people, more of these workers, frontline workers, to take care of our elders. I mean, there's a shortage of nurses and doctors, yes, but there's also a shortage of well-trained, well-paid immigrant and minority workers who are take care of these elderly every single day. So, you know, it's just not the issues of, the option, I mean, the decision make of the family, but also has implication on immigration issues, you know, training of these poorly, you know, paid workers and, you know, the shortage of these workers as well. So it's kind of...
Right. Maybe I could throw that to Secretary Kerry. Yeah. I think that's obviously an issue you've been grappling with. Where are... Is Massachusetts like New York? Are we seeing a lot of immigrants and... caregivers and where are we getting them and what does that mean for the future?
Caregivers come from a variety of backgrounds. There are certainly the professional caregivers, some of whom we saw in the films, and family caregivers. But the caregiver shortage really is a critical shortage for a host of reasons. One, the pay is modest. It is very difficult work, very demanding work physically, demanding work emotionally. Also, the career ladder is very limited. There is some work here in Massachusetts to provide options and career ladders for people who are going into that field, but it is difficult, challenging work. One of the things that we've done here in Massachusetts to address the caregiver shortage is to do things to try to make life easier for family caregivers. Our caring homes and enhanced adult foster care or enhanced adult family care are two responses to that. But it is very difficult. So.
Oh, lots of questions right here.
They talked about the medical care that's extending the life. It's also making it very difficult because you live a lot longer and so your quality of life is not as great. And I'm just wondering, do you think there will be a shift that at some point as we kind of go through this aging tsunami where we start to see the effects of it, more and more people aging, will we stop giving certain advice to extend life when you're late 70s, 80s, et cetera, because we see that the quality is not going to be so great? It just feels like we're making decisions early on when you are in your 70s and 80s that are going to make it much more difficult for you as you get into your 90s.
Is this happening, Dr. Pyles? Maybe you could grapple with
you
that.
You see that. Maybe it's going to be a trend in the next, you know, decade or so.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
The quality of life is not measured by longevity. It's really measured by function and your capacity to really enjoy different activities and relationships. But I agree with your impressions that with all of our advanced technology, what we've done is created a large subset of older adults who in turn are institutionalized or living very closely connected to a healthcare system and really unable to live at the level that they had previously enjoyed. And there's no way to predict these things, no way to anticipate the changes ahead. And so as one of the caregivers mentioned, it's just one small decision at a time, and as things progress, you can never anticipate where this path will lead you, and so it's difficult to make large assumptions about how we can address the larger issues.
There was also, I thought, in the film a hint, maybe we could sort of extend this discussion a little bit, a hint of another, of a counter, almost countervailing idea, which is as younger people, people like us, we don't necessarily... The ideas we have now about where we would want to stop care and at what point life would no longer be bearable is not necessarily the same once you age and you're changing slowly. And I'm not saying this very well, but it's sort of buried in there. But it's the countervailing idea, I think, to what you're describing, that we don't know what we're going to think until we get there,
and
about how long we want to go on. I've had extraordinary experience with my father, who went through all kinds of problems with heart failure and all the operations. He wanted to do every one. He astonished me, his sort of tenacious hold on life. It seemed to be life itself, as I think someone says in the film. And some of you have those experiences as well. It was truly surprising to me. Big strapping man, a mental logger who had been really deteriorated, but there was nothing he didn't want to do at the end of the day. And it wasn't just us pushing or us hanging on to him, I don't think. It was really him and his own life force. It was quite a really eye-opening experience, unexpected and eye-opening experience. And that seems to be happening as well. People, you don't really know what each of us might think when we get in those situations.
And I think related to that is, I think it's critically important to have these conversations at every point that we're able to have them. This film, I think, will provide an extraordinary starting point for some of those conversations within families, because I do think that these are family and individual decisions, and they will vary by person. But it is important, as both of the doctors have said, to recognize that each decision has implications beyond just that moment, beyond just that procedure, that it has implications down the road in terms of lifestyle, in terms of subsequent choices.
And that's what the professionals know, because they've seen it so many times. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably where we can take great instruction from all of you in these individual circumstances.
That's true. You know, feeding tubes have never been shown to improve quality of life or length of life. They have not been shown to reduce risk for infection. They increase risk for aspiration pneumonia. The decision about a feeding tube is a huge decision. It certainly would not come up if a patient were terminally ill. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I want to extend your question because this terrific movie is raising this whole question, and that is, what is terminal illness? And at which point does it become terminal? Now, we have hospice. And hospice, Medicare has said, well, you can be in hospice if we have a 6-month prognosis, which is reasonable, but that was a financial decision. And now you can go for an extension, and that makes good sense. So well, we have a terminal illness, which could be end-stage metastatic cancer, end-stage congestive heart failure, end-stage pulmonary disease, pretty straightforward, and you can sort of predict when the end is coming near. So you're not going to be having a discussion about feeding tubes and so on and so forth. But there are many, many patients with Alzheimer's disease, which ordinarily has a longevity of approximately 10 years from the time of diagnosis, where death comes from pneumonia, urosepsis, those kinds of things. These patients are also terminally ill. And when you get to the eighth or ninth year, it raises the question, do I want a feeding tube in my 85-year-old mother with Alzheimer's disease when I know she's probably not going to last 2 more years? Or do I want to take her to the hospital to treat this finding on her x-ray or this breast mass? Does it make any sense? This movie raises all these questions, which is why I think it's such an important film. I think the next question that's going to be raised as a result of this, at least I feel, this is the second time I've seen this, is it's going to raise the question of what is terminal illness, and at which point should we intervene earlier to affect not only the patient, but the family, because it's the families that are the most devastated by some of these diseases, which you saw here.
In regards to this, I was surprised to see in the film that there was one individual that wanted to entertain that he would have the authority or the control to end his life when he felt that it was no longer the way he wanted to live. Now, how soon do you think society or the legal system is going to support something like that. Because I think that is, I think it's a very important thing, especially as we have the aging of these people over 85. The other end, we've got these preemie babies they're trying to keep alive at 1.7 ounce, and all those take huge amounts of care. And then we have people like my son, who's severely retarded, who is 35 and functions at the age of 2, who has been in full-time care for practically all his life. So how much of this can society support as we have this 70 million people at age, over age 85?
And that's more than a financial question, I think, too,
yeah.
Right? Yes, exactly.
But what about, do you think about the legal and the right to make a decision that you want to be able to affect your own termination?
Well, you're really talking about euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide.
Mm-hmm. Well, wasn't that what he was implying?
Yeah.
At the lower. No, he was talking about that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, yes, he was. And there will be such a huge difference of opinion. You know, it may come down to a financial decision, although somehow this country manages to come up with lots of money for things that don't make a lot of sense. And so...
would you like to give us a list? I'm sorry. We'd have to ask everybody.
So, you know, I this will be an ethical debate that will go on and on and on, and I don't think any of us will ever really have an answer. And like you said, it's going to be an individualized decision.
Right.
And it is something, this film raises, families are going to see this film and they're going to get together and they're going to start talking about this. What do I want now? It may change when I get older, but let's start having this conversation now. That's what this film is going to raise. Because I go to nursing homes and that's exactly what it looks like. That's exactly what it looks like. I'm not going to be one of those patients in that nursing home. Which is also what the physicians in the film said. I don't have an answer for you, but...
I think right back here, the woman in the blazer.
I just wondered about other states. There are some restrictions on procedures that can be done to people. Isn't that true in Oregon or Washington?
No. I think Oregon does have a
Oregon
system, right? Yeah.
Well, and it has to do with an age. Someone over 85
well,
can't have.
Well, I think it's Medicaid, isn't it, in Oregon? Medicaid.
I think I think it is Medicaid, right?
Yes.
Exactly.
It's only Medicaid?
Yeah. Well, it's all the state
absolutely.
Really controls. The state government really controls. So
I can't believe that they would restrict. That's like the whole issue of abortion. Anyway, but England, for instance, makes decisions about what. Procedures are available. And
well, I can comment on that because my brother lives in London. And most European countries have what's called socialized medicine. And what they have is they have a budget, a set budget. And what happens that year has to stay within budget. What happens is there's a queue for having your gallbladder taken out. There's a queue for having your hip replaced. And those queues get longer and longer and longer. And so the quality of care, does the quality of care suffer? And some feel that it doesn't. And they spend far less money on medical care than we do. And yet the longevity in Europe is just as great as it is in the United States. In fact, the birth survival rate is far higher in most countries in Europe than it is in the United States. So money is not the answer. Pouring money into the system is not always the answer. Even though I think that's part of the reason that we're not getting the best and the brightest to go into medicine anymore or get folks to go into primary care and geriatrics especially. I think money is part of that. But the other part of it is that this is the now generation. You know, the X generation, the now generation, and they want to have a life. And they see us as not necessarily having as much of a life. We don't go home at 5 o'clock. And the current generation wants to go home at 5 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. The greatest proportion of healthcare dollars are spent in those final years of life. And I think it's not equitable, as you're suggesting in your question. When there's there's so much need across a whole spectrum of a lifespan. So it really involves legislative change and Medicare reform before we can talk about how we might allocate these precious resources to deal with primary care concerns as opposed to some of these degenerative diseases that we probably can't reverse at this time. Too much money is spent on the final weeks, months of life. But who's going to set the limit and say, no, not this time? So it happens at a national level.
Back here.
I realize this is more of a bioethics issue, but one way that we could set the limits is to let individuals have the ability to say when the cutoff is. I know as difficult as it looks to watch someone who's growing old and getting physically frail, the loss of mental acuity is terrifying for most people because you totally lose control. Now, I guess some people say that you shouldn't worry about that because you don't know what's happening anyway, but people do realize it. And I just think it's terribly cruel to make people live knowing that they're just going to become almost a vegetable. And we're not going to have a cure for Alzheimer's in the near future. I mean, I'd love to have that happen before I get to that point. But, you know, I think there has to be, someone has to say it's time not to get between a person and their God or their concept of God. I mean, I'm in the medical profession, and I'm tired of having too many of us being forced to play God and taking away these rights from the patient.
But isn't this all, and people in the kind of condition you're describing, it really comes much more down to a family decision, I would assume, than even the individual themselves, which is, I think there were several examples in the film, actually, of family members who want to hang on as long as they can.
If you look at older adults over the age of 85, nearly half of them are suffering from some Alzheimer's disease or... this is the fastest growing portion of our society, we can imagine the enormous medical burden that's going to unfold over the next generation. And if these older adults are unable to go to the hospital or get their care at the clinic, then they suffer at home, right? They're not getting the care they need. So I think more of our healthcare decisions need to focus on home care for older adults, because that's where the home is delivered. That's where the care is delivered. It's in the home. We have a large and very effective home care service at Cambridge, and we really deliver top-notch geriatric medicine and psychiatric care in the home. But that system of care really doesn't exist across the country, except in some few centers. And what happens is this raises the burden of decision-making to the hospitalists, when somebody's brought to the emergency room in some acute condition. Suddenly, tubes are put in, tests are done, they're sent to the ICU, and really this is where the costs escalate.
I think that really is the portion of the glass half full part of the story, is our ability that we have certainly seen over the last, certainly the last decade, to care for people more effectively in their homes, right, and to manage chronic disease much more effectively than we've ever been able to, as a result of advances in medical technology, advances in prescription medication, and so forth. The number of people that you see with portable medical devices and the ability to do long-distance medical monitoring really has grown tremendously, which means that we can care for people more effectively and more safely than ever before, which means that people, we are able to delay the nursing home placement, we are able to extend the amount of time that people can live independently and with a solid level of functioning in the community more than we ever have been able to. So,
one of the things that we're working on is a way of avoiding that midnight transfer of the elderly patient with Alzheimer's with a fever who calls the primary care physician who says, well, send her to the emergency room. Because what would happen is she'd get admitted with her pneumonia or urosepsis or whatever. The hospital is a dangerous place. More tests, more studies, finding more things at more cost. What we're trying to do is, nationally, is put together what's called the team concept in primary care medicine. Not just geriatrics, but all of primary care. And I think over time that's one of the solutions that at least I think may be effective. By team care, what that means is a primary care physician, nurse practitioner, and nurses and other paraprofessionals, including medical assistants and so on and so forth. So that in the nursing home, at midnight, there is a nurse practitioner. And the nurse practitioner goes to the bedside and sees that patient, makes the diagnosis by physical examination, something that has been lost in this day of CAT scans and MRIs, makes a decision about what's going on and begins antibiotic therapy at that point, involving family members in the decision-making as well, and hoping that the family members would agree that keeping this patient in the nursing home is the right thing to do. So this whole team concept where we lean a little bit away from the primary physician, where there are not enough of them, to make these decisions, to getting more of our paraprofessionals and colleagues to be involved in making these decisions would be less costly for sure. And the end will come sooner because the therapy is not going to be quite as intensive. But then it comes again to the conversation with family members about how we're going to treat our moms and dads when we're at this stage in the nursing home. So it's a complicated answer, but I think what you're going to see in the next 10, 15 years, even in primary care on the commercial side, patients under 65, you begin to see this team approach to care because it's less expensive.
I would like to address the idea of the younger people talking about aging and what's going to happen then, because I think we are such a youth-oriented culture that people don't want to talk about getting old. I'm almost 75 years old, and people say, oh, I can't believe it. That's not the point. The point is...
Well, it's one point.
Well, it's... But we get old, just like children have to be taken care of, and we know a lot about child rearing. We don't talk to people about what it's like to get old. Physicians don't bring it up. Your family members don't bring it up. It is sort of a taboo in our society. And I think until we can bring it out of the closet, and yes, you get old. And when you get old, you can get sick. But what are you going to do about it? How are you going to stay healthy as you age? And I think it's very important to bring this factor out.
I think that's absolutely crucial. And one of the directions our society has taken is the segregation of people by age. We used to have multi-generations living in the same household, and that is a rarity. In many ways, it's a tremendous blessing because individuals get the care they need, and also family members get to see what the reality of the lifespan is from birth until the end. And so aging and the issues associated with aging are not something to fear, but something to be recognized as a part of the lifespan. Also because family members are so spread apart, we have in many ways professionalized what had been a family neighborhood community function, so that if there was not family available, neighbors pitched in, or there were, the old concept of the home for the aged and that sort of thing has sort of disappeared. And so a lot of these functions really have become very specialized. There's a specialized vocabulary. They're not a part of normal conversation and so forth. So I think you're absolutely right with that.
So get us all back in the same building, basically.
That's right. That's right.
We're here.
I have a couple of things. Would you, the physician, personally ever recommend a feeding tube for anybody in your family?
A feeding tube for?
Anyone in your family under any circumstance?
If I had a family member, for example, who was in an accident and was unable to take nourishment by mouth as in the course of recovering, sure, I, I, I consider probably peripheral TPN first and then maybe a feeding tube. It depends on the circumstances. But certainly not in a situation where there's a dementia that's mid to late stage. It's not been shown to improve longevity or quality. So I'd say no. And certainly in a situation where it's a terminal illness, I would say no. I'd have no trouble doing that.
And do you know if in the Netherlands where euthanasia is legal, if there is controversy, if people feel like it's abused or people feel like it's a gift to have it as an option?
It's less controversial because it's such a foundation of that society. And it will grow within Europe before it does here. We'll probably see it in Canada soon. Is it a result of a system that can't support itself because most of the European systems can't support themselves financially? They run into the red year after year, and they continually have to look for more funds. And I wondered if maybe that's where this came from, but I don't think so. I think that this is a lifestyle decision that people in that part of the world made. But it's not going to grow very fast, and its acceptance in the United States, at least I don't think I'll ever see that.
And I don't know what the data actually shows, but you certainly hear the anecdotes that a lot of the impact of having that ability to have physician-assisted suicide actually, not that many people actually use it at the end of the day.
That's right.
It's having the sense of control is the important thing, much more than actually the act, I think, seems to be. That's just anecdotal evidence I've certainly run into as we've done this. We did a film in the Netherlands when they were just putting this into place many years ago now. It was intriguing. It certainly was.
I think also one of the things that the film does not address, though, that is important, is all that we are learning about healthy aging and what people need to do to maintain healthy lifestyles and for healthy functioning. And those are lifestyle choices that we can make that truly will affect the quality of our aging. And that is something that each individual has control over and something that I think we need to have significant conversations about and embrace how to think about ways to support healthy aging. Yeah. So.
Back here.
My compliments to the producers of this film.
Yeah, they did a wonderful job.
I think
the
title really is great, Living Old. That word old?
That was their title. Usually Frontline comes up with the titles for our producers, but that was their title, and we stuck with it.
Excellent. Yeah. I work with Senior Care Alternatives, which is the private paid division of the Visiting Nurse Association of Boston. And we see a lot of baby boomers coming to arrange care for their parents. And what we see going on is what I would call a dress rehearsal for their own aging. That this is waking up the baby boomers. Mm-hmm. So my question for each of the panelists, and I think that Dr. Dupuy started to get at this when he talked about the need for a team approach. If you were talking collectively to baby boomers, what they can do, not just individually about their own health, but what they can do collectively for changes in society, what would each of you set as the 1, 2, 3 most important things that baby boomers should be speaking out about? They've changed other things before. Perhaps they can have change in this area too.
I guess I would say there are a couple of things. One, I think it is important for people to plan for their own future and to plan for their own aging in every aspect, to think about what they want the last third of their lives to look like. The baby boomers, in general, as a cohort, are one of the most well-resourced, most well-educated populations in American history. Now, granted, there are wide disparities in that, but as a whole, that's what the boomer population is. And so as a result of that, they will be able to take control over what they want that portion of their lives to look like. It means taking control of health. It means taking control of financial circumstances. It also, for many people, will mean thinking about what they want, quote-unquote, Act Two to look like after their formal professional careers are over and their formal input into the working place. What are they going to do with what may be a very significant portion of their lives still to come? Will it mean more civic engagement? Will it mean second careers? Will it mean lying on the beach sipping a piña colada? What will it mean? And what do people want to craft that portion of their lives to be? So,
although someone in the New York audience last night said, the problem is baby boomers don't plan.
Right.
I don't know if this is true or not. It's sort of
But I think that I also find that this is a significant boomer issue because people now are faced with addressing the issues of aging parents. And if these issues were not front and center before, as soon as someone has an elderly relative that whose care they are in some way responsible for, this issue does become front and center. So.
All right. Well, I couldn't agree more with Secretary Kerry. I think the baby boomers are the informed consumers. When I work with older adults who have depression or anxiety, and I might recommend a medication, it's usually the patient who says, accepting the doctor as they have for generations, yes, doctor, whatever you say. It's the son or daughter who goes online and checks to see, well, what are the side effects of that medicine? Mm-hmm. You know, what exactly am I getting into? So supporting that informed
the WebMD generation.
Exactly, yeah. But also a great deal of focus must be placed upon education and on every level. In geriatric psychiatry, we have the same problems as in medicine that Dr. Dupuy was mentioning. There's a huge shortage of geriatric psychiatrists, only a few thousand across the country. We're only training less than 100 every year. We can't entice them to come because of all of these problems we've already articulated. So it's reform at the level of support. We've lost our funding for our fellowship. Our Title VII federal funding disappeared with this current administration, and that is a tragedy, not just geriatric education, but also geriatric research. And so the baby boomers as voters, we can't get people to apply to our geriatric psychiatry fellowship, not just here in Cambridge, but across the country. So what we've done is we've gone into the medical schools. Now we teach medical students about geriatrics. So you heard a statistic about only half of medical schools teach geriatrics. 10 years ago, that was more like 10-15%. So we've made a great deal of progress. Now we have the medical students rotate through geriatrics and learn about what it's like to sit with an older adult. And not just the ones who are in the ICU or in the hospital, but also in the home or in the nursing home or different levels of care. So it's integrating the students into that treatment team model. And then at a local level, I bring my children to nursing homes. I think it's important for them to see what it's like, and not just to visit relatives, but just to go and visit. It's an important part of our culture. It's only about 5% of older adults, but you see what happens as we age. The numbers escalate dramatically. So we have to be good, informed consumers.
My mother used to do that to me, actually, when I was quite young.
And you turned out okay.
Well, I'm here, and I'm sympathetic. In fact, got me in an accordion band because they played for the seniors all the time.
Oh, that's great.
That's when I pleased her the most, was me and my accordion playing, whispering hope for the old folks home.
I think we have time for one last question.
Okay, somebody got a really good one? Right here?
I think I have a really good one. I want to thank you for inviting us here for this.
It's good. It's a great discussion.
The beginning of a conversation. You're a great group. Have you plans for continuing this conversation? Because I can think of a long list of people in groups who should be exposed to this and might miss it on Tuesday night, like the political leadership in this country. Also,
that idea has come up in every screen that every congressman should see this.
I would hope so. And also the leadership at our medical schools and our educational institutions. But right now, the professional geriatric societies and aging associations, are there any plans to bring
them
into the
conversation? Well, we made some. I mean, the thing I understand about Frontline is this: most of our films are done so close to air. We don't get to do occasions like this or get to do a lot of testing of the films before we see them, before the audience sees them. They're kind of finished, and we get them on the air, and then we're moving on to the next thing. But we have done a lot more work with this. Several panel members here were at focus groups we did with professionals trying to... So we've done a lot of work so far in Massachusetts trying to figure out these connections. We found a lot of interest among medical schools. They think it's going to be useful to them, this film alone, in engaging their students in this arena, and have been some real excitement about that. I think there's some other things. We're trying to find out how this thing can be useful in more than the usual way a television program is useful. Beyond that, I think Frontline is, just because we're run by baby boomers and all this stuff, I think inevitably this is we feel like we're opening the door. It's not that we haven't done aging issues before, but it's been pretty sporadic. And now, because it's going to start to dominate our culture anyway, and because we're getting even more curious just as individuals. In fact, this film really started as a conversation. You know, we were trying to figure out what to do next with the team, the lovely team that did this film. But what we really started talking about were our own parents, with the very issues we've been discussing tonight. And you know, the executive producer of Frontline, David Fanning, is a native South African, so he's living in Boston. His mother is in Cape Town, South Africa, or Port Elizabeth, South Africa. And his sister is in New Zealand. So there they are. You couldn't have a more long-distance international family, and they're struggling with it constantly to try to figure out how, and he has a mother who's aging well, but still, you know, her frailty grows every year. And so we just started grappling with this, and out of that, out of our own curiosity, very personal curiosity, and including the question of what's going to happen to us when we hit that stage of life, we sent our team off to go exploring, and they came back with this fairly wide-ranging portrait, and I'm sure we'll do more, probably even including the healthy aging story, which has come up in many, many circumstances. So I think we're opening a big venue over time that we will continue to explore in many ways, and I'm very provoked by your idea of what's a terminal illness, I have to say. And that half of people over 85 have Alzheimer's? I mean, those...
Oh, yeah, 50%.
That's sort of jaw-dropping, actually.
I went to the initial screening for this, and the first thing I said was, our congressman needs to see this. Right. And the second thing I said is, I'm bringing this to my medical school. Mm-hmm. Now, Tufts is one of the medical schools that does have a very, very intense exposure to geriatrics in the second year, and several of us are involved in that. And this was just about a month ago, all of the medical students, all 160 of them, go to various nursing homes for 2 afternoons to interview patients. This is their beginning of patient interaction, and to get family histories, not physical diagnosis, but histories. It is fascinating to watch the students' excitement with their first interaction with history taking, understanding of medications. These folks that they interview are all very elderly. Some are very ill. Some have aged quite healthily. And we've been doing this for just about 10 years now. So that schools like ours, Harvard does the same thing. Sinai, of course, has been doing this for a long time. You know, that's the upside of all of this. But to hang on to that enthusiasm for the next 2 years of medical school and then 3 or 4 years of residency is the key.
Do you find more students engaged by this process you're taking through, thinking about that as their focus?
If we're lucky, we might get, as I have this year, one resident who's going into a geriatric fellowship. So it's time intense. There aren't enough academic teachers. There's only a few of us in the city. There's a few more in New York, but it's a bigger city.
Right.
But that is part of the solution. Education is clearly the key.
So the real answer to your question is we've started with professionals here in Massachusetts and trying to spread out. We made some great connections with Mount Sinai and been spending some time with them. So it's not what we normally do to sort of try to change issues ourselves. We do our journalism and hope it has an impact, but a positive impact. But I think it's in the end it's going to take people grabbing on to the contribution we've made and finding uses for it. We're just doing more investigation than usual about what those uses may be. And I think this is a kind of film because it's what we call an evergreen. Its value sustains over time, unlike some more, you know, near-term investigative films we do. So, Thank you. The extensive website is not. There's a little preview website that's there now. But if you go at the, we put the website up at the moment of the film premiere. So 9 o'clock on Tuesday, November 24th. So I don't know if you've ever checked out our websites. Many of them are quite wonderful. We've done a lot of work with this. There'll be a lot more information about all of the people and the cases in the film. A lot more extended interviews with the doctors and nurses who are in the film. A big list of resources for people who need help and people who want to get more politically active as well. We commissioned a really intriguing essay on the spiritual dimensions of aging and end-of-life issues, which is we didn't explore in much depth in this film, but it's clearly there and interesting. Lots of interesting. Plus, you may or may not know that we stream all of our films, have for the last 3 or 4 years now. There's 50, 60, 70 of them up there now. So it's available all, it's like a book in the library now. So you don't have to just do it on television. It's quite a good player now, and if you have any kind of broadband, it's easy to do the film and explore it again or email your friends about it if they happen to miss the broadcast. So there is a kind of sustained value to these things, which we've been trying to pioneer with our websites, but we're always going to do something special with this film. We're working very hard with the professionals to try to figure out where this is of use. I know what it's going to do in families, what someone described today. It's going to, I think you did, Secretary Kerry, it's going to provoke those very intimate family conversations. It can't help but happen.